I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. A heated debate continues across the country as states including Missouri and Alabama have passed bills restricting or criminalizing abortion, and in some cases, before a woman even detects that she is pregnant. Today, understanding why one in four women in the U.S. will terminate a pregnancy by age 45. We'll look at the data to understand who these women are and what brings them to the decision of abortion. Then, some music makes you tap your feet and sing along, while other genres have you quickly changing the tune. There's a scientific explanation for it all, and we'll explore the reasons behind your musical tastes. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. To say that recent abortion legislation passed by Alabama and Missouri lawmakers caused an uproar would be putting it mildly. Amid all the controversy, we wondered this: who's having abortions and why? There's data that offers answers to those questions, and that's what we'll be looking at now. Joining me now from NPR studios in New York City is Rachel Jones. She's the principal research scientist at Guttmacher Institute and is a leading expert on abortion in the U.S. Rachel, good morning.
Good morning.
Dr. M. Antonia Biggs is also with us. She's a social psychologist at the University of California, San Francisco. She's led studies on why women decide to terminate pregnancies. Dr. Biggs joins us via Skype from San Francisco. Dr. Biggs, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Well, Rachel, how are you able to assemble information, you know, on women who have abortions?
Well, there's a couple approaches. You know, a lot of health departments collect data, but actually Guttmacher does periodically, every 6 or 8 years, will do a national survey of abortion patients, you know, approaching clinics across the United States to gather information from women who are having abortions. And that's how we know what we know.
And there's a lot to look at here, isn't there? Because you have age, you have race, ethnicity, relationship status, even where the woman herself was born. The most recent survey that Guttmacher did on U.S. abortion patients, what was when, Rachel?
In 2014 is when we collected the data.
And were you able to sort of compare and contrast the two recent studies?
Yeah, so our prior study before that was done in 2008. So, yeah, there was a lot of comparing what had changed about abortion patients over that six-year time period.
I was going to say, what were some of the most substantial changes you found when you analyzed these surveys?
Well, perhaps not surprisingly to us anyways, is that the proportion of abortion patients who are teenagers or under the age of 20 continued to shrink. They only account for about 12% of abortion patients.
Why didn't that surprise you?
Well, just because teen pregnancy and birth rates have been going down, so this just falls in line with that. Fewer teens are getting pregnant,
okay.
So fewer teens are having abortions.
And what else surprised you as you analyzed the different surveys?
Well, so what we did see that we didn't consider to be a good development is that there was an increase in the proportion of abortion patients who were poor, low income. In 2014, 75% of abortion patients, again, had poverty or near poverty level incomes.
Hmm. If the numbers show one thing, Dr. Biggs, it's that there's no one woman who's representative of who's choosing abortion. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that what we know from Dr. Jones's work is that many women have abortions in the U.S. The figure is about 1 in 4, and that includes all kinds of women who from all incomes and races, ethnicities, and it's really everyone.
Let's
could,
look
could
at
find
some,
themselves in that situation. Sorry.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's look at some of the characteristics of the women who have terminated their pregnancies. What age groups do they fall into, Rachel? What do you find out there?
So most commonly, about 60% are in their 20s, are young adult women, and an additional quarter are in their 30s. And like I said earlier, about 12% are teenagers or under the age of 20.
And Dr. Biggs, were many using contraception at the time they became pregnant?
Well, I can't speak for Dr. Jones's work, but in the work that we've done through the Turnaway study, we have seen that most women report that they were using contraception at the time that they were seeking abortion.
Most women do, yeah.
Most women,
yeah.
So about 65%. And I don't think that's very surprising, because we know that birth control doesn't always work, and it's always hard to, for many women, it's very hard to access birth control services because they need a prescription, and it costs money.
Rachel, how many of the women that you surveyed already had children?
Good question. About 60% already have children.
60%. Okay.
Yes.
Dr. Biggs, what do we know about the impact on families when women are unable to obtain an abortion?
Well, we at UCSF have conducted something called the UCSF Turnaway Study, which is led by Dr. Diana Green Foster, and we followed women for 5 years, and we compared women who had an abortion to women denied an abortion. And what we found is that the women who denied an abortion after we followed them 5 years later, they were much more likely to live in poverty. They were much more likely to experience serious complications from the end of pregnancy, including eclampsia or even one death. They were more likely to stay tethered to abusive partners. They were more likely to suffer from anxiety and loss of self-esteem, and to lower their aspirational life plans for the future. And we also found an impact on their existing children and future children in terms of their economic well-being and development.
I was going to say, impact on their children, you're talking about their financial standing going forward in their lives?
Yeah, so what we did is we looked at the women that, so many women who seek an abortion do so because of they're caring for their existing children, and they want to provide their existing children a better life. So we looked at what happened to those children, and we found that they, the women who were denied an abortion, their existing children were more likely to live in poverty than the women who were able to get a wanted abortion.
Rachel, let's turn to income, the income status of women who have abortions. What trends have you seen there?
Well, like I said earlier, we saw between 2008 and 2014, there was an increase in the proportion of abortion patients who had poverty or near poverty level incomes. And again, when you put that together with their young women raising children, you can see when you impose these other barriers about laws and whatnot, or remove clinics and make them travel further, that it becomes a very difficult thing to do.
And what else do you know about the income status of these women and the impact it has on their lives, Rachel? Did the survey show you anything else?
Well, so we, unlike Antonia and her colleagues, did not follow people over time. So like I said, we know what their income was at the time,
okay,
when they obtained the abortion. We also know, for example, that most of them were paying out of pocket for the abortion. Most of them had health insurance. About 75%, I think, had health insurance but weren't able to use it to pay for the abortion. So, again, don't have a lot of money, don't necessarily have access to great health care, and are having to pay for this procedure out of pocket.
They weren't able to use their insurance because the insurance didn't cover it. Is that what you're saying?
Well, a lot of abortion patients have Medicaid coverage, and in most states, Medicaid will not cover abortion care.
Dr. Biggs, is there a spiraling effect here if you're unable to plan family size and you're already struggling financially? What do you see there?
Well, in our work, we found that financial reasons were the most common reason women gave to seek an abortion. So the idea that they couldn't afford to care for their child or their existing kids due to their existing economic situation. And then when we followed them to see what happened to them, we found that those who were denied of abortions and carried to term, they were more likely to live in poverty, they were less likely to work full time, they were more likely to be raising their children alone, to be receiving public assistance, and to not have enough money to meet their basic living needs.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking this morning about what we know about women who decide to have an abortion in the wake of these big legislative sessions in Alabama and Missouri that have created such an uproar across the country. Rachel, what do we see when it comes to the education level that women had or were pursuing, and then the connection with abortion?
So admittedly, we are pretty rudimentary on that. We just ask about the highest degree that they've obtained. And among abortion patients under age 20 and over, a quarter of them have college degrees, and only about 1 in 10 don't have a high school degree.
So a quarter of them have college degrees, okay. And what was the percentage that don't have high school degrees?
9%.
9%, okay.
And this is 20 and older.
And the takeaway from the education question would be what, Rachel?
These are women who seemingly have the resources, the educational resources to pursue job opportunities, but obviously given their incomes, they're not able to. That maybe a college degree doesn't carry as much value as we think it does.
And Dr. Biggs, I'm guessing there's a domino effect here. You know, stopping pursuit of an education because of pregnancy can mean less financial opportunities to support that child and offer a better life. So the child may have more challenges in life as well. Would that be a proper estimate there?
Yeah, I think that's true, and that's definitely what we found, is that the children who were born after being denied an abortion were more likely to live in poverty, and the mothers were more likely to report poor bonding with those children. Mm. Another interesting thing that we found was that the women who were denied an abortion, they lowered their aspirations for their future. So they might have had initial goals in terms of education or career, but once they were denied an abortion, they realized that those probably weren't goals that they would be able to attain. So they changed their goals and lowered them.
We're going to turn now to the reasons for why women choose to end a pregnancy. But if you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our number, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. What are some, some surprising, is it the reason that women offer a combination of reasons for why they choose to end a pregnancy? Let's look at a number of them here. Financial reasons, Dr. Biggs. Is this parent saying we can't afford a child or another child right now? Is that the bottom line?
Yeah, I think that financial reasons are complex, but yes, it's that they can't afford, given their existing economic situation, they can't afford a child, given that they already have kids, or given what they want in terms of their future.
What happens to those families financially when they can't get an abortion? What do we know there, Dr. Biggs?
So what we find is when they can't get an abortion, they are these women who are primarily wanting an abortion due to financial reasons, we find that they have four times greater odds of living below the federal poverty level than those women who are able to get their wanted abortions.
Four times as great a chance, you're saying?
Yeah. That's what we found when we followed them for 5 years.
And Rachel, your study, we mentioned healthcare a minute ago. Your study looked at health insurance coverage and payment for abortions. How wildly do the various policies stand out there as you survey those?
Could you elaborate a little bit more? What specific policies?
Yeah, I mean, do policies vary wildly in terms of whether they will cover an abortion or not?
Right. It's a little bit of a black box in some way. So, you know, Medicaid across the board, federal Medicaid dollars does not pay for abortions except for, you know, rape, incest, and life endangerment. A lot of federal health insurance has the same restrictions. A lot of state impose the same restrictions. Interestingly, in Missouri, private health insurance is prohibited. It's my understanding is prohibited from being used to pay for abortions.
Okay. Again, our number, 816-235-2888. Let's go to some phone calls here. Gail from Baser, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. I applaud you for having the show on.
Good.
I appreciate the topic. My question is, what impact does anybody know about that's going to be on child services as a result of all these interesting abortion restrictions? I think it's going to be monumental, and I haven't really heard anybody discuss, have somebody from Child Services give their input on that topic.
What do we know, Rachel, about the impact on Child Services, the different agencies across the country?
Yeah, admittedly, we don't collect data on that. I have a feeling Antonia might have some insights on that.
Okay, Dr. Biggs?
So, I mean, what we do know is that the women who are denied an abortion are more likely to receive their chances of receiving public assistance definitely goes up after they're being denied an abortion, as their chances of living in poverty increases. So along with that comes everything else. And now they have one more child to care for.
Right. Okay, let's go to Frank from Lawrence. Frank, you're on the air.
Yes, my question has to do with not only before Roe v. Wade when it was illegal, but even presently, as you mentioned, some women who cannot get a safe and legal abortion may try to self-abort. Do you have any statistics on who does that and any death rate on women who try that? I'll take the answer off the air.
Yeah, thanks, Frank. Women who self-abort.
I'll start, and again, I think Dr. Biggs has some insights in this as well. We do ask abortion patients on our survey if you've ever attempted to self-abort. We find that about 1% to 2% indicated they have. But most commonly, they do it using things like herbs that they've heard are supposed to induce a miscarriage, or drugs like misoprostol that can be bought over the counter in some countries and that are actually pretty effective, can be pretty effective if taken correctly at ending a pregnancy. We don't necessarily have a very good sense of how often that occurs. I mean, I do also want to say that if abortion is outlawed or in states where it becomes inaccessible, I don't think we'll see a return to back alley abortions. I think it'll be these drugs that can be obtained that make it safer for women to do their own abortion.
These drugs weren't around pre-Roe v. Wade, Rachel?
Right. They weren't around.
Yeah. Dr. Biggs, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I want to say that we definitely know that women are self-managing their own abortions. It's really hard to get a sense of good statistics on that, but we know that women are doing that. And we also know that women have abortions all around the world, whether it's legal, restricted, or not. We can look to countries we can look to our states where women are less able to access abortion, but we can also look to countries where abortion is completely banned, and we see that women still find a way to get an abortion. So it's not something that we can make go away through legislation. But what we do know is that the women who are most strongly impacted by these restrictions are the women with the fewest financial, social, and emotional resources. Whereas those who can overcome the barriers to care will be able to find a way to get an abortion, either legally or not, I would say.
Dr. Biggs, you also say that a third of women cite partner-related safety concerns as a contributing factor here. What is seen happening to women who carry to term in a relationship where their physical safety is at risk? I guess we're talking about abuse here.
Yeah, that's right. So we definitely had women who cited concerns about physical abuse as a reason for not wanting to carry to term. I have one 40-year-old woman who described her reason for seeking an abortion. She says, "Our relationship became violent, and I couldn't see bringing another kid into a life that was going to be surrounded by violence." And so when we followed those women, we found that the women who were in abusive relationships and were denied an abortion were more likely to stay tethered to that man involved, whereas the women who were able to get their abortions, they actually experienced a sharp decrease in violence from the man involved in the pregnancy. So they were able to avoid the abuse.
Right. Rachel, does your survey look at the relationship status of the women? And if so, what did you see when it comes to those who are single and those who have a partner?
Right. So we do look at relationship status. And I'll just give you the facts. 15%, 14% were married, 31% were cohabiting with their partner, and then the other 55% were either never married or divorced.
So most of them were never married or divorced. Okay. Let me ask each of you what you foresee with the current restrictions that states are placing on access to abortion. What possible impacts could there be on women and families going forward, Rachel?
A lot. And it's going to be something that's going to be hard to assess and measure. But again, and I think Dr. Biggs will have a lot of insights into that based on their research. But it's going to, again, given that most women who get abortions are poor, low income and have children, if they're not able to access care because these laws are so restrictive that all the clinics have to close, or if it's outlawed altogether, this is a population of women who is going to either carry a pregnancy to term that they didn't want to, or going to have to figure out a way to get to a state where they can access care. And it's going to create more financial difficulties and logistical difficulties for them.
Rachel, as you watch the court battles, do you anticipate that something as dramatic as Roe versus Wade could be overturned, or are you expecting something less than that, in at least in the immediate future, the next few years?
And I'll acknowledge my D.C. colleagues are the ones that are most well-versed on this.
Sure.
You know, there's so much going on, it's hard to keep track of all the moving parts these days, and we can't be surprised by anything. I'm not sure, given the cases that are there right now, that we expect Roe v. Wade to be overturned in the next 6 months or a year. But again, I could be very wrong on that.
Mm-hmm.
But Roe v. Wade doesn't have to be overturned. If they just keep imposing restriction after restriction and make it impossible for clinics to stay open, then that's just as good as overturning Roe v. Wade.
Dr. Biggs, I'm wondering what you think, what you anticipate here, the impact of the current restrictions that states are placing on access to abortion and what impacts there could be on women and families going forward.
I agree with Dr. Jones. I think that we are already seeing in some states essentially an absence of Roe v. Wade. And what I anticipate going forward is that we were going to see the women with the fewest resources, the fewest emotional, financial, and social resources who are going to be impacted the most. And those women who are unable to get their wanted procedures are going to face the same things that we've already seen in the Turnaway study, where we see an increase in poverty, a challenge that their children suffer. They are more tethered to abusive partners. So all of these outcomes are things that we're just going to continue to see more of if we don't offer women access to care.
Okay. That's the voice of Dr. Antonia Biggs, a social psychologist at the University of California, San Francisco. She joined us via Skype this morning. Dr. Biggs, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Rachel Jones was also with us. She's a principal research scientist at the Guttmacher Institute and a leading expert on abortion across the country. Rachel, thank you for your time as well.
No, thanks for having me on.
Time for a break. When we come back, why you like the music you do and why you don't like the music you don't like. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, a former Lenexa principal opened up about his battle with severe depression and his hopes to destigmatize mental illness. You can hear my conversation with him at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, mayoral candidate Jolie Justice will talk with Brian Ellison about her strategy to win over Kansas City voters as we close in on the June 18th election. Tune in tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, here's today's thought question. Are you a Rolling Stones person or a Beatles fan? Are you an Adele fanatic or a Brandi Carlile fan? So why does one person dig one performer while another person heads in an entirely different direction? And why does music have such a profound effect on us? Nolan Gasser plunges into these enormous questions in a new book, Why You Like It, The Science and Culture of Musical Taste. Nolan knows something about taste. Besides being a composer, pianist, and musicologist, he's a chief architect of the Music Genome Project, which powers Pandora. The project helps consumers find music that fits their own taste. Nolan Gasser joins us now from the studios of KQED out in San Francisco. Hey, Nolan, good morning.
It's great to be here, Steve. Thanks.
I'm fascinated by this Music Genome Project that you put together for Pandora any number of years ago. You were the chief architect of it. Where did the idea for that come from?
Well, I mean, it was really at the right time. The music industry was in a state of flux at that point. You know, CDs were starting to wane, and this whole notion of digital music was coming on. This was the era of Napster in late 1999, early 2000. And I was actually at Stanford completing my PhD in Renaissance musicology, not thinking about music technology really much. And I got an email from a fellow named Tim Westergren, who was a practicing musician, a pianist, a composer. And through a series of epiphanies, he realized there was an opportunity to do something different about how people get connected to music. And so he got some funding and joined forces with a few other guys, in particular a guy named Will Glazer, who is a sort of a brilliant engineer, who was actually the brains behind the algorithm from an engineering standpoint. And the idea really was to sort of marry intense music analysis with this sort of approach to an algorithm to make better sort of recommendations, to figure out what's going on under the hood of the music. Mm-hmm. So we cannot worry too much about chart position and the status of an artist, and help regular musicians find regular fans in a more sort of even-handed way.
So this idea is you can tell Pandora that you like Toto and Louis Armstrong, and you'll get songs that sort of fit that interest level.
Sure. So, you know, what we do in terms of the Music Genome Project, we sort of divide music into different species, if you will, again, keeping that sort of genome metaphor going. And there are six different genomes corresponding to the major genres of pop and rock and jazz, hip-hop, electronica, world music, classical. And each one is broken into hundreds of variables, genes. And so we actually have trained musicians. Some people don't realize there's actually sort of a person behind every song recommendation, because these trained musicians who are jazz musicians or rock or classical musicians, during the day they put on headphones and stare at a computer screen as they listen to music and literally code hundreds of variables.
That's
so
amazing.
So, you know, we can get a sense of the overall connection between two songs. So if you pick, you know, an artist like Louis Armstrong, we'll start playing music, you know, Louis Armstrong and Louis Prima, or, you know, early jazz. But by virtue of your thumbs up and thumbs down, you're training the algorithm to say, you know, actually, I like the small band more than the large band. I like his vocal stuff more than the instrumental stuff. You know, so you can really, again, train your stations, because music operates on many different, you know, sort of wavelengths, if you will. And so the reasons why you may like one song versus another are many.
Right.
And that's just from a purely musical standpoint. The book goes a lot deeper than that.
Right. What made you think you could even begin to sort this out? Because music is so incredibly complex. It's constantly evolving. And there's so much of it that it just staggers the mind.
Well, it is certainly a daunting task. And, you know, any service that says they can get it 100% right, I think, is sort of kidding itself. I mean, there are so many variables just within the music itself. And what we try to do is to really to be objective and to quantify. People say, well, art is subjective. How can you really, you know, be sort of scientific about it? But the whole realm of musicology is dedicated to, you know, sort of a strict and formal approach to analysis, so we really can figure out how the melody and how the harmony and how the rhythm is structured. And so we can figure out in a quantitative way what's going on. But again, you know, so much of our taste is a product of our upbringing, of our personality. And so even if you get it 100% right on the purely musical level, you know, there's always going to be factors that are at play that we'll miss.
Well, maybe you're answering this next question, but I'm wondering what you learned as a result of piecing together this Music Genome Project and getting a PhD in musicology and about what shapes an individual's personal taste in music.
Right. Well, certainly what we were very excited to learn and to show to others is that there's so much that's going on that, you know, even if you're a trained musician, you're listening to the music and you're sort of in that zone, you're in kind of an aesthetic position and you're following the music, you're not necessarily conscious, unless you're analyzing it or you have that kind of ear, what's going on in the harmony. I mean, hopefully you are aware of that. But for your average listener who's not trained, there's so much that's going on in the way that the harmony operates, the way that instruments are used, the timbre of voices, that reflect what we like. And so we may not know that we love chromatic harmony or really syncopated rhythm or the use of, you know, choral counterpoint. But when those things are operating in a song, in one song that we know we like because we listen to it all the time in an intentional way, we can then, you know, play music that shares those parameters. So it was certainly great for me to recognize the power that a purely musical sort of approach, digging again under the hood and sharing that information in an intuitive way with people, can really open them up to music that they obviously didn't know and didn't know that they would like. As we all know, we all put sort of blinders on. We all have our sort of biases. And that's, you know, something we all need to be aware of, and something obviously I explore even more in the book.
I was going to say the book again, Why You Like It, The Science and Culture of Musical Taste, the author Nolan Gasser, who is my guest. I wonder if we could play a couple of songs here that you list on the book's website, whyyoulikeit.com, Nolan. And maybe Sure. You can describe them in ways that will help listeners begin to understand how these songs are put together so that they're drawn to it or repelled by it. Mm-hmm. Let's start with, again, a song you have on the website. This is Guns N' Roses' Sweet Child O' Mine. Now, a lot of folks are going to recognize that song, Nolan. Tell us a little bit about it. What strikes you about it? You there, Nolan? They were talking to Nolan Gasser, his new book, Why You Like It, The Science and Culture of Musical Taste. Are you there, Nolan? So I think what we're going to do in the meantime is we're going to listen to Guns N' Roses' Sweet Child O' Mine just a little bit longer.
Yes, I'm here. I haven't gone anywhere.
Okay, Nolan's back with us. Nolan, what strikes you about that song as we listen to it there?
Right. Well, I was saying, you know, that it's a great example of those many varied, sort of varied things that are going on in a piece of music that we kind of take for granted.
Yes.
There's so much to talk about. You know, for one thing, one thing we hear, obviously this isn't in a kind of hard rock style. Mm-hmm. So that comes with certain pre-notions. Slash's guitar, Axl Rose is, you know, kind of a bit of a gritty voice.
Right.
But musically, there's a lot of sophistication going on here. In that opening passage in the intro, there's this, what we call an arpeggio, right? There's an arpeggiated figure in the guitar that acts as what is called an ostinato. This is actually something that goes back to classical music in the 18th century of Mozart. Huh. This sort of figure that kind of continues and repeats and provides this sort of steady kind of groove as we hear it.
Right.
But then we hear the second melody come around. So it's counterpoint. Now, counterpoint is, again, something that goes way back into Western music history, back to the Baroque era and earlier. We don't often think about counterpoint with pop music because it's kind of a sophisticated technique, but it's there. And if we're drawn to that, we're following these two separate musical ideas, one upon the other, and that kind of gives the music this sort of, nice, you know, sort of narrative quality to it. That the song creates kind of a harmonic loop with this great progression from the 1 to the flat 7 to the 5. I mean, we can get into the nerdy weeds, but these are things that, even if you're not, you know, paying attention, factor in. That kind of steady repeating harmonic loop, if you will, is something I talk about quite a bit because it's omnipresent in music of all genres. It's something that we can actually sit in, and it kind of, it's static and changing at the same time.
Well, it's fascinating to hear you describe this in the way that you do. Do you think Guns N' Roses was thinking about any of this when they composed this song?
You know, it's a great question. I mean, they clearly are very gifted musicians. And so, I don't know that they study music theory enough to take the AP exam. But certainly from from some level of training and certainly their ears, Slash is obviously a very gifted, that solo that he takes is really a masterful solo. That's not, done by someone who doesn't have great craft and experience.
Right.
So I think, just as with the Beatles and any great, pop group, Cage the Elephant, it doesn't matter. I mean, when there's really sophisticated things going on, it's because they were aware of it. Maybe they had help from a good producer, in the space of George Martin to help guide them. But, one doesn't need serious academic training to be able to carry out some pretty sophisticated things.
Well, let's listen to a different track again from the same set list that you offer on your website. Again, this is the Kinks' big hit, You've Really Got Me.
So I can't sleep at night.
What strikes you about that song, Nolan?
Well, there's so much again. We're so used to a sort of distorted guitar.
Yes.
We have to realize in 1965 or what year, every year that came out, it was so new and so brash, even before the Stones. I mean, that line, da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da, that's what we call a riff or, again, an ostinato. It's that repeating. It just carries out through the song. It changes to different pitches, but that really is that glue. There's the timbre of Ray Davies' voice, that kind of, guttural grit. Harmonically, it's, so much of rock and roll is based on the blues, right?
Mm-hmm.
And especially those English rockers in the early to mid-60s, they were fascinated by Howlin' Wolf and the Chicago blues style. And so there's a harmonic progression, which is typical. You go from the one chord, kind of a dominant seventh chord, so not just a major chord, but with that flat seven, and usually goes to the four chord, so from D to G.
Mm-hmm.
But what they do in this song is they trick you. You think it's going to go to the four chord for that second chord, but it goes to the two chord from D to E, and it's a surprise. It's one of those things that psychologists talk about as really being one of those triggers for chills when we're expecting something, but then we're surprised.
Huh.
But it's not a bad surprise, right?
Right.
And that's really part and parcel of the power that music has. By if we're following it consciously or even not so much, these things are operating. Our brains, as I say, are music processing machines, and so we are getting all of those, creative juices from the artists into our brains and bodies.
You know, Nolan, in your book, Why You Like It, you talk about harmony, you talk about rhythm, you talk about melody. Just curious, which one is the most important ingredient? Is there one?
Well, if I knew that, I'd be on my yacht in the Mediterranean. I think it sort of depends, if you will, on what the music, what the realm of the music is. I mean, one thing that people don't often think about is, we think of harmony, we think of chords and chord progressions. Well, the West, and really the West only from around the 16th, 17th century, is really the only place where a system of harmony developed. Most of the world, it is melody.
Hmm.
You go into the Middle East, into Africa and Asia and India, these brilliant, rich traditions. they're much more focused in on the melodic characteristics. That's why their scales are often more sophisticated in terms of not just the notes of the piano, but the notes between the keys,
right.
Microtones. So in that music, melody's more important. In that Kink song, I don't know. I don't know that melody is the most important. So I think it depends both on the music and on you.
Well, what an interesting survey of why we like what we do. The book, it's worth checking out. It's been highly critically acclaimed out there. The book, Why You Like It, The Science and Culture of Musical Taste. You can also go online and look at Nolan's work, whyyoulikeit.com. Nolan Gasser's been my guest. Hey, thanks so much for your time, Nolan. I sure appreciate it.
Absolutely, Steve. Thank you.
You bet. Coming up, Brian McTavish and some cool stuff to do on your weekend. That sounds like a whole lot like World War I.
Yeah.
And Brian McTavish is here to talk about Memorial Day weekend stuff, and there's a lot going on out there. Welcome back.
Hey. How welcome are you? Back to me too. Yeah,
yeah.
Happy to be here. So pack up your troubles in your old kit bag and smile, smile, smile. I remember as a kid singing that out on the playground.
Is that right?
Well, it's a nice little melody, so I submit melody is the most important
part
of any popular song. But of course, this was a World War I song. And it really put a very brave face on the conflict, on the terrible conflict. And this is apropos, of course, because here we come, Memorial Day weekend activities,
right.
Friday through Monday.
Kansas City, home to that great World War I museum.
And yes, that great
museum. And it is a great museum.
Oh, it is a great museum. And in so many ways that you should explore it and appreciate it this weekend. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, you can try to find your connection to World War I. That's the theme this year of activities at the museum.
How
will you
do that?
Well, here's how. Thank you. You invite the public is being invited to connect with the war, discover how it affected your family through records, through photographs, and a lot more stuff, programs, interactive, hands-on stuff. I would point folks all weekend to the museum and check out the World War I research stations, right? They will give you access to a whole bunch of databases, of course, Ancestry.com. There's the museum's online collections database. You can check out the American Battlefield Monuments Commission, even the National Archives, and figure out who in your family lineage might have been involved, and maybe you didn't even know it. Or you can write a letter all weekend to troops, as they did during World War I, right? So write a letter to veterans or deployed troops or new recruits or first responders. And then there's so much more. There's so much family stuff to do.
Right.
I mean, kids can like actually touch dozens, if not more, of actual World War I objects.
Right.
And then, of course, on Sunday, there's the Kansas City Symphony's annual patriotic concerts, including fireworks, festival. That all gets kicked off at 3 o'clock Sunday on the North Lawn of Union Station.
Okay. Only you would find a song about Stonehenge. I mean, I bet you had to look for that one.
I didn't find it. Yeah. Spinal Tap found it. Now, I'm playing this with a little tongue-in-cheek, if you'll allow me to do so. Here it comes, the American premiere of a traveling exhibit that investigates the enigmatic European monument known as, yes, Stonehenge.
Wow.
5,000-year-old monument, you know, that circle of super heavy stones about 100 miles away from London over there.
And so, it's still a mystery.
It's still a mystery, but trying to cast some light on that mystery is Stonehenge, Ancient Mysteries and Modern Discoveries. That's the latest American traveling exhibit to show up at Union Station. It opens Saturday. It's the first time anyone has seen this stuff in the United States of America.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. Now, did I mention how old Stonehenge is?
It's old.
It's 5,000 years old.
Wow.
Who built it?
We don't know.
Nobody really knows. Nobody really knows. But through 300 or more original artifacts, half of which have never been outside of Europe, you can maybe try to figure it out. There will be multiple hands-on interactive activities for all ages. But let's see. Modern archaeologists posit that it was a calendar, a solar calendar. Oh. Maybe it was a burial ground. Maybe it was a place where people were executed ritualistically. We don't know, but go find out. It opens tomorrow, no, Saturday, and all the way through September at Union Station.
How years ago, in days of old, the magic filled the air. Just in the darkest depths of Mordor, I met a girl so fair. But got her at the evil one, crept up and slipped away with her, yeah.
Man, I love that song.
Yeah, yeah.
I could just sit here and play that for the rest of the time.
It's an option.
That's a good song.
It's your show.
It's
okay.
Zeppelin.
It's Zeppelin. Ramble
not,
on.
Now, they're not going to be here.
Nah, well, they kind of are. Okay, now, here's Zeppelin, right, singing about the depths of Mordor and Gollum. It's all about the Lord of the Rings. I find it interesting that this weekend you can go check out Conquest 50, the 50th annual science fiction and fantasy convention, Friday through Sunday at the Sheraton Kansas City Hotel at Crown Center. Now, this is all made-up stuff, so I have Zeppelin singing about made-up stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
And previously, we had a fake band Spinal Tap singing about a real thing. So I give it to you. I give everything to you here. I give it my all and all the time. So anyway, Conquest 50.
Anyway,
that was a brief but hopefully semi-meaningful digression. Conquest 50, it's a science fiction and fantasy convention, right? So there are so many great panels, right? And like you can check out the Affairs of Wizards, or you can find out how to...
Or you can come into my house and listen to Zeppelin.
Well, there is that. Am I invited?
No.
Anyway, Game of Thrones musical chairs. Let's go and do it at Conquest 50 this weekend downtown.
From your
what do we have here?
Toots!
Toots.
Toots and the Maytals.
Yes.
Jamaican Reggae Legends, 8
wow.
o'clock Friday night at Crossroads.
Oh, that'd be fun.
KC. What is a Maytal? Well, let me tell you, it's the Jamaican word for good and pure thing, and that certainly describes the music of Toots and the Maytals. In 1968, Toots and the Maytals released a song called Do the Reggae.
Mm.
Now, they spelled it R-E-G-G-A-Y, but it was the first popular song that ever used the word reggae, and so it is credited with giving the reggae genre its
name. Toots and the Maytals are responsible for that.
They are, and they'll sing this cover of the John Denver tune. They'll do Pressure Drop, maybe Funky Kingston, Bam Bam, Monkey Man. Check them out.
And finally today.
I love my dog. Yes, I love.
We all love our dogs. This is a dog show, not a cat show. And what do we have about dogs going on here?
You say what you want, and I'll say what I want.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's the dogs.
No cats.
Day
just dogs.
Out. Well,
yes.
I'm here now. I'm sitting here with you.
Yes.
I like the cats, but it's Dogs Day Out, so you can take a garden stroll with man's best friend from 9 to 6 Saturday. They have special areas where I guess dogs can't do too much
damage.
At Powell Gardens. Now, if dog is man's best friend, who is woman's best friend?
I don't know.
I don't want to say the wrong thing.
I don't either.
But I think maybe cats.
Yeah.
Maybe. Would you deny that potentiality?
No.
Am I being too general?
No.
Am I painting with too broad of a pet brush?
You got about 15 seconds.
Just keep brushing your pets.
Okay.
That's what I say.
Yeah.
Maybe a hairless cat would appeal to you.
Yeah.
No okay.
Cats.
Well, take
no
your
cats.
Dog out to Powell Gardens and maybe don't bring your cat, or maybe do.
Okay.
All right.
That's Brian McTavish in your weekend to-do list. Thank you, buddy.
Thank you, buddy.
Yesterday on the show, a Kansas City Marine detailed the honor but gut-wrenching task of bringing Marine Corps casualties to their final resting place. You can hear that in previous conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, our film critics are back for a review of the documentary Independent and Foreign Films You Should Be Watching. Join up-to-date for that conversation. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up-to-date.